This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's hardly a newscast these days without weather porn. In January 2017, it was Houston flooding, mudslides in California, and an Oregon town or two with canoes in the streets. Over 230 Americans have died in flooding since 2015. Many more perished around the world as extreme precipitation events pop up on every continent. But what if extreme precipitation gets even worse as the world warms? What if rains beyond our experience swamp the infrastructure of cities or wipes out crops? A new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences seems to predict that is exactly what will happen. Our guest is the lead author, Dr. J. David Neelan. He's a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at the University of California in Los Angeles. Neelan has published over 150 papers during the past few decades. David Neelan is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the American Geophysical Union. He leads UCLA's Climate Systems Interaction Group. David Neelan, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
Well, you've done such deep research into both atmospheric science and the behavior of oceans, it's tempting to say you're a kind of hybrid specialist. Is that true?
Yeah, my group first made its name working on El Nino and taking apart why we get these warm and cold events down the Pacific every 2 to 5 years, typically, and some of the implications of that. And this is an example where universities figured out a phenomenon, and then that got turned over to the National Weather Service, among other places, for routine forecasts that we now have, some of which are right and some of which occasionally are wrong.
Well, that's the way weather forecasting goes. Now, to prepare the stage for our conversation today, there have already been papers looking into the relationship of extreme precipitation and a warming world. And I'm thinking of the work by Dr. Paul A. O'Gorman, for example, or Lehman's paper from the Potsdam Institute in Germany. That was titled Increased Record-Breaking Precipitation Events Under Global Warming. David, what sets your new paper apart?
Yes, it's important to situate this in a long track record of work on precipitation and how we project based on climate models that will change in the future, and also work on trends in extreme precipitation that have occurred over the past decades. So it's not a new thing to say that the extremes of precipitation are going to increase. What we looked at specifically is accumulations of precipitation from when you start raining to when you stop raining. So precipitation accumulations, and that would be in millimeters if you're a scientist, in inches if you're an American. And one of the questions has been that if the intensity of rainfall increases, so you get more millimeters in an hour, do you rain shorter, or do you keep raining and get more rain over the course of the event? And our study specifically addresses that, sure enough, you accumulate more over the course of an event. And we did two things. We were looking at a theoretical point of view where we can derive some things from the moisture equation of the atmosphere, governing how much moisture you have in the atmosphere. That in the first place, we were just interested in explaining something in current observations. And as we were doing it, we realized that this implied that the accumulation should increase in a rather specific way. The probabilities of large accumulations should increase in a rather specific way under global warming. It's consistent with what you expect from the work on intensities or daily averaged rainfall that's happened. And it puts another piece in the puzzle.
What I found different in this work, and really I had to work through two stages to understand it, and the first is the principle that there's been a limit to the amount of rain that can fall from the sky in a certain period, and you call that a cutoff point, and sounds like a good thing, maybe nature's way of keeping us from drowning. Can you explain what those limits are?
Sure. So if you think about your accumulations, how much rainfall fell from when you first felt that drop of rain to when it's not necessarily the sky cleared up, but it was no longer raining, you put down your umbrella. It's really common to have, say, an event in which a fraction of a millimeter would fall. And then if you go up to an event where the accumulation would be, say, a couple of millimeters, that's still pretty probable, maybe a little less than a tenth is probable. And then you go up another factor of 10, you know, to 10 millimeters, that's substantially less probable. But still, you know, you're going down by about a factor of 10, a little more than a factor of 10 each time you go up to the factor of 10 larger event. That's known as a power law. And then at a certain scale, certain number of millimeters that's typical for each region on the planet, the tropics would be different than, say, mid-latitude North America, you reach a scale at which your probability starts to drop about exponentially, i.e. pretty fast. So your number of events you experience larger than that cutoff is much, much less probable than the range of occurrences that you would get on the smaller accumulations.
Well, then comes the second stage, and this is really the worrying part, is that this cutoff limit will change as the world warms. Could you tell us about that?
Yep, and it's essentially taking things that are already known and twisting them to apply specifically to this accumulation, how much falls in a given event. You have a certain amount of moisture variability in the atmosphere. The large-scale motion of the atmosphere is converging moisture, and that tends you to drive you up till you get to high enough moisture that you start raining out. And what we found is that the range of the smaller events is governed by the statistics of those moisture convergence fluctuations. And then you get up to a point where the amount of rain that you have dropped out really enters into the equations, and that sets the scale for any given region. So it's a trade-off between these fluctuations and the fact that you're raining, you're losing water from the atmosphere. As you increase the amount of water vapor that's in the atmosphere, you tend to increase the size of those moisture fluctuations, and that pushes your range where your probability of larger events drops slowly up to a slightly higher value. Your cutoff occurs at a higher value.
Well, I can remember a couple of years ago, Great Britain was hit with a string of superstorms, and drainage systems that worked since Victorian times completely failed, and some villages that hadn't flooded since the Middle Ages went under. So, David Neelan, are you saying we can expect to see more record rains in parts of the world?
Yes, this is what this is saying. And it's consistent with, you know, quite a number of other studies that have looked at this from different point of views. So it's putting another piece in this puzzle with a little more theoretical underpinning, and then a rather large ensemble of climate model simulations to look at the way that this does change in a full complex climate model that includes representations of all the weather events that you would have.
And there's a word in your paper I had to revisit because it's not something we use every day. If we want to grasp what precipitation modeling can and can't do, we can't avoid that term stochastic. What does stochastic mean, and how does that affect your work?
Yes, so stochastic essentially means a process that you're representing as having a random component, one where you can't predict the precise fluctuations from moment to moment, although you are able to say things about the statistics. And we borrowed a big chunk of theory from the physics literature that uses these stochastic processes. And we use this to make statements about the way the statistics of extreme rainfall will change, even though you don't expect to be able to predict a century in advance the exact weather patterns, you're treating those as effectively random on timescales longer than a week or so, but you're still looking at the way that their statistics will evolve. And that was used in the theoretical prediction part of the study. And I have to say that theory was motivated by just understanding observations we had made using the Department of Energy has these wonderful data sets from high-resolution measurements of rainfall at many places in the world, and that's where we were first noticing this rather simple distribution of probabilities of the accumulations. They were, in observations, having this slow drop as you went up, each factor of 10 in size, and then this fast drop. And so when we were explaining that using the stochastic model, we realized that there were these implications for global warming. We went and took the National Center for Atmospheric Research large climate model and ran 15 runs in normal climate of 30 years each, and then 15 runs in a high greenhouse gas scenario for future climate, and looked at the differences between the accumulations in those future scenario runs versus the current runs, the current historical greenhouse gas runs.
You know, I really appreciated that explanation. I've understood your paper better for hearing that. I've noticed that the arrival of extreme precipitation events has been very uneven. The Potsdam Institute reports hazardous rain increased by about 12% globally, but in Southeast Asia, the increase was 56%. Why are some regions magnets for extreme precipitation, like the U.S. Deep South, while others are not?
Some of that has to do with the particular types of weather system that they get in each region, and the ways that that can change. So if you, for instance, have a change in the timing of your deep convective rainfall of a monsoon system, for example, that changes in a way that can potentially be slightly different than our mid-latitude rainfall that comes from frontal systems. But we have to say we don't understand everything about the regional changes at this point. You're essentially, when you're asking questions about global warming, the question of, is the planet warming when you put increased infrared radiation trapping gases in the atmosphere? That one's relatively easy. The question of, you know, exactly for my specific region, how is the rainfall going to change in this particular year? That's a tougher one. So we tend to make these statements that apply across broad regions.
Well, you know, just for fun, I looked up the largest amount of rain that's fallen in any American state since records began, and it was 42 inches over a meter of rain that fell in 24 hours in Texas. That was in July 1979. But it turns out measuring rainfall isn't as easy as it sounds. There are things that can distort the whole process. What are the best tools now for counting how much rain falls in a particular place or region?
So there's a number of measurement methods. There's various types of local rain gauge, from things that are essentially glorified buckets with, you know, careful wind sheltering and so on, to optical gauges that count how many raindrops are falling past a sensor. And those are at the ground-based station level. And then there's a large investment in satellite technology for measuring rainfall from space. Those are always estimates based on the amount of raindrops and their effects on the either microwave radiation coming up from the clouds, for instance, or in some cases we have space-based radar on satellites that essentially ping and look at the hydrometeors in the clouds and estimate the rain rate from that. And the satellites have great spatial coverage, and then you're typically checking them against the ground-based observations to calibrate the rates. You like to make statements when you're doing things from observations that combine all of these data sets.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and our guest David Nealon was educated at the University of Toronto before getting his doctorate from Princeton. He's been at the University of California, Los Angeles for quite a while, and we're talking about new science showing extreme precipitation is coming as we disrupt the climate. Well, it seems to me you're beyond just using computer models. You're expert enough to evaluate different models and their shortcomings. Some people are suspicious of computer modeling and climate science. How can we have some confidence in the work that you've done?
So one of the significant things that I, for instance, always tell my students is you don't necessarily want to put all your faith in one single study, and certainly not in one single model run or one single set of observations. You're always looking at an aggregate of multiple studies by multiple groups on the same thing. And in the case of the increases in precipitation, That's why I was mentioning the background of multiple other research groups that have looked at this both in observational trends and in predictions from the climate model over the, basically now we're talking about almost two decades that this has been looked at. And so we're gradually making our statements with increasing confidence about the increased probability of very large precipitation events.
Looking back through your past papers, it's a pretty impressive work. You've gone into such large and complicated problems, and my guess is that only grad students can really carry on those kinds of conversations. If you go to a party and somebody asks what you do for a living, David, what do you tell them?
At first I would tell them about El Nino, which sort of hit the public scene around 1997, more than a decade after we started working on it. Now, if you tell them you're a climate scientist, they have plenty of things to ask you about, so that's not really a problem. I teach a undergraduate class in climate modeling and climate change that started out maybe 15 years ago with 7 students and now has to be capped at 120. So this is definitely something that you can talk about at the undergraduate level. And I sort of pride myself with being able to have conversations on this across the political spectrum. I find if you calmly explain what you know and why you know it, that people listen, people get it, at least in one-on-one conversation.
Okay, well, to me, this is really jaw-dropping science. I mean, destructive and deadly rains are coming as we alter the atmosphere. How do you feel about it?
I do want to put some perspective on this in that the changes in probability of a really large event that we're, for instance, finding in the climate model, they're increasing by hundreds of percent by the end of the century under a scenario where we do little to limit the emissions of greenhouse gas. If you limit the emissions of greenhouse gas, you would limit the increase in the probability of these large events. And I'm an optimist. It's taking a long time. The first big study that came out on global warming summarizing the existing science was in 1979. So it's been a long road, but there's much more awareness now. And even if one could wish for faster action, I do have confidence that society as a whole, people will step up and do sensible things to evolve our energy infrastructure over time and invest in cleaner technology.
Well, you must have several research balls juggling in the air at any particular time. David Neelan, could you talk to us about what you're working on now or hope to tackle in the near future?
So we have a lot of research on the fundamentals of precipitation processes. And one of the things that one is always working at is improving the way climate models simulate this, and weather model forecast models for that matter. At this point, the weather forecast models and the climate models are very, very closely related to each other. So we work back and forth. As I mentioned, we do some theoretical work, but we also have a big observational effort where, for instance, we're taking data from Department of Energy field programs, for example, or many of the satellite data sets that are now available from NASA and NOAA satellites. And we're scrutinizing in a detailed level exactly how the precipitation onsets when you have a given temperature and moisture structure in the atmosphere, for instance. With an aim of using this to fine-tune, improve the representations of these processes in the climate models.
And what does the Climate Systems Interaction Group at UCLA do, and what sort of computing power do you have available to you?
So one of the great things is that the National Center for Atmospheric Research, among other institutions, as well as some of the Department of Energy laboratories, they maintain large supercomputer infrastructure, and you can apply for time on that, computing time on that. So we do most of our big computing using collaborative infrastructure, collaborative computing infrastructure, and collaborative models that are have hundreds of scientists contributing to their maintenance and improvement. So you can have a graduate student hop on to a very sophisticated climate model like the National Center for Atmospheric Research model and be able to modify the particular thing that they want to improve and get a run going without having to individually maintain that infrastructure.
Well, you don't have to answer this next question, but I'm wondering, you say you're an optimist. Do you think the new Trump administration will succeed in dampening American climate research to any degree?
My graduate students have been asking the same thing. So, you know, I like to think that sensible, when it comes down to it, people tend to make sensible decisions. And so I'm optimistic that there'll still be room for research. By and large, the U.S. has been fairly good about not having politics interfere at the level of scientific research over the past, and I'm hoping that some of that continues. In any case, even if society makes decisions to not move quickly to limit greenhouse gas emissions, that's a decision society can make. We, you know, we're in a democracy, and the climate scientist's job will only become more important if we decide to do more rapid global warming than we have been, because we'll need to know with more precision what those consequences are going to be that we will have to adapt to.
Well, and my feeling, too, is that American climate science has been pretty advanced. I mean, there's great science in other parts of the world. We know that. But American scientists have led in many fields. And I think there's so much momentum in that that I don't think a four-year term, and I'm hoping that's what it might be, can really draw the strings on that, can really slow it down that much. And if it does, it'll bounce back very quickly.
One of the other things that is worth mentioning is that climate science isn't just about global warming. You know, for instance, I mentioned much of my early work was on El Nino and its consequences, and that's a natural climate variation. Much of the statements about extreme rainfall and, for instance, the work to improve weather and climate models, that is every bit as useful for weather prediction, which has, you know, substantial use to people across society. They're the same tools of the same graduate students working on these natural climate variations as are looking at, okay, what happens to these weather variations when you warm the climate? There's no distinction because you're working on the same phenomenon and how it tilts under natural variability or how it tilts under human-induced climate change.
All right, we're going to have to wrap this up. Is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
One of the interesting research frontiers at the moment is one of attribution of probability of specific events to climate change. That's something that you'll be hearing more and more in the news, and it's worth taking a listen to that. These are early days in that. We're not, my group is not directly engaged in that, but we know groups that are, and we know the tools that they use. And that's as we move forward more and more into the warming era. You know, we just had another record for the global average temperature this past year in 2016, and there's every reason to think that that will keep going. That thinking about how this is impacting specific groups in society, who is in harm's way when you have a greater probability of a flood event, when the 1-in-100-year event becomes a 1-in-20-year event, what are the consequences of that? Those are things that it's worth paying attention to from a point of view of adapting your infrastructure, what municipalities need to do to invest in their infrastructure, what are the business impacts, opportunities, and risks. Those are all things where it's worth listening carefully to what's being said.
We've been discussing the paper, Global Warming, Precipitation Accumulation Increases Above the Current Climate Cutoff Scale. The lead author is Professor J. David Nealon from the University of California. This paper contains a warning about precipitation events getting even more extreme as we warm the planet. You can find links to the science we've discussed and to Dr. Nealon and his lab in my show blog at ecoshock.org. David Nealon, thank you so much for sharing your time with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.